Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today I have one of my favorite people on, Dr. Marilyn Singleton. And I was just telling Dr. Singleton, she is the number one downloaded podcast in the history of my show. So I'm very, really, really happy to have her back, because when she talks, you need to listen, because she knows not only medicine, but also the law. And in these day and age, I think we need to have a facility to discuss what's happening to us on both levels. She is the past president of the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons. She's also a board certified anesthesiologist. She graduated from Stanford and earned her MD at UCSF Medical School. She completed 2 years of surgery residency at UCSF, then her anesthesia residency at Harvard's Beth Israel Hospital. While still working in the operating room, she attended UC Berkeley Law School, focusing on constitutional law and administrative law. She interned at the National Health Law Project and practiced insurance and health law. She also teaches classes in the recognition of elder abuse and constitutional law for non-lawyers. And this is somebody who, at this point in time, is going to be able to add some knowledge instead of all the heat and fire that we've all been exposed to. So, Marilyn, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's always a pleasure.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. You know, I enjoy it so much, and I am just so glad you have this show. People need you, Dr. George.
Well, thank you. I like to say that my blood pressure is normal because I'm able to get what is on my chest off of it by having the show. So it's been a good experience, and we're in really, really interesting times, and we're getting a lot of information about COVID. And I know that AAPS wrote an article about the various masks. With the president recently being diagnosed with COVID, there's been a whole onslaught of, oh, he should have worn his mask and blah, blah, blah. So I wanted to get your take on the mask situation.
Okay, I did a review of many, many articles, and they're well into the hundreds that have been written about masks. Very few randomized controlled studies that they've done. And even with those, they're kind of hard to tell. And basically, these studies have compared the N95 mask, and that's the one that the hospital personnel wear, and other masks, these cloth masks you see people wearing, and the gaiters and these various things. And without all the gory details, it looks like the only mask that truly works is the N95. And just for terminology, the reason they're called N95 is because they filter out 95% of these very tiny particles that are less than 3 microns, you know, really tiny. And given that the human hair is about 150 microns, so just as a sense of size, and these viruses are very small, so the mask certainly can't filter them out unless it really is a tightly fitted N95. Now, granted that larger particles, like if somebody sneezes or spits or whatever, will be trapped by the mask. And if you take the mask off right away and take it off properly where your hands don't touch the spit, and then you put your hand back up to your face, then that's okay. But if you don't take the mask off and leave it there, the so-called virions, the whole container of the virus, can certainly work its way through. And these regular cotton masks and the designer ones that have your football team's name on it and whatnot, excuse me, are not made out of the kind of material that good masks are made out of. Good masks are made out of a material that has something called an electrode that has ions moving back and forth, and that's what helps kill the virus. So there's more to it than just having a covering. So yes, the covering would protect you somewhat if somebody is a spitter when they talk or they sneeze or cough on you, have some reason where you get these big droplets on you. But you'd have to immediately take off the mask, put it off somewhere, and wash your hands after handling it. And so in that sense, there's sort of a false sense of security if somebody says, oh, I have this mask on, so I'm protected. And you really aren't. And just yesterday, the CDC came out for sure, because at first they said this was a draft where they said that coronavirus is spread by aerosols. And what aerosols are when just the virus is floating in the air without the medium of saliva or whatever else it's going to pass through. So if it's in the air, it's in the air. And there's really not a whole lot you can do about it except stay in well-ventilated places. That's why being outside, there's a minimal risk. And in fact, most people say you have to be around somebody for at least a half hour if they're infected and if you're in a well-ventilated space. And the people that tend to get sick are people that are in poorly ventilated spaces, like who got infected in New York, people who were on the subway, who got infected, nursing homes, because they are closed spaces. So with this whole mask issue, we have to use common sense. You don't hang out with people who are sick, and if you're sick, stay home and wash your hands, wash your hands, wash your hands, because too many studies have shown that the filter efficiency of these masks are minimal.
Well, thank you for that, because that puts a foundation on what we're being told. And do you think, I mean, it seems to me that they're asking for something impossible. First, it was about slowing the spread, and that's why we were supposed to stay home. And now they're talking that it will never go away. Like, you're looking for a zero positivity within a population. That's unusual. That's never going to happen, is it?
Well, no. Do we have zero people ever getting the common cold? And now, don't say that, oh, she said coronavirus is like the common cold. But it's a very nasty bug, but it's a coronavirus, just like two kinds of coronaviruses cause the common cold, and then there's two kinds of rhinoviruses that cause the common cold. They're around, and they're floating around. They'll always be around. There's all sorts of viruses that are out there and that our bodies fight off with its own natural immunity. And we just have to face the music with that. Now, the coronavirus, or COVID-19 is the name of the disease that the novel coronavirus gives you. The technical name, the real name of this coronavirus is SARS-CoV-2. And why is it called that? Because it's very similar to the SARS virus that came out in 2003. Well, what happened to the SARS virus from 2003? Our good friend Dr. Fauci himself had done some research on it, and they were looking for ways to treat that and looking for a vaccine. And then lo and behold, after 11 and a half months, the first SARS just went away. It just went away. Now, every now and then, people pop up with it. And the same thing happened with MERS. That was the Middle Eastern virus that came out in 2009. And it just went away. There was no vaccine, no special medicine, no nothing. And so we certainly cross our fingers that the same thing is going to happen with this one. There was a guy, I don't think he was a doctor, an epidemiologist back in the 1850s named Farr, F-A-R-R, who made a curve that epidemiologists still follow. And the bottom line of this curve is what goes up must come down. And so the rapidity that you peak out your infections and deaths and whatnot will come down at pretty much the same rate that it went up, and deaths follow 10 days to 2 weeks after your peak infection. And that appears to be what's happening now. And so there's certain things that follow science, and it's looking like this SARS-CoV-2 virus is acting that way, and we shall see. But it's incumbent upon us to just use our common sense.
I think that was, you're absolutely right. And it should make people feel good that there is an end point. We just have to do smart things to get there and not be inundated with negativity. On that note, let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Marilyn Singleton, and she has a website, Marilyn Singleton, MDJD.com. And it's everything you want to know about what's relevant. She has blogs that she writes, and this is a thoughtful person. I recommend highly that people go to her website. Now, you know, we're coming into this election season, and there's been a lot of talk about the Affordable Care Act. It went off the page for a while. And as you know, I'm no fan of the Affordable Care Act because I think it doubled down on the most expensive parts of the healthcare system at the expense of both the doctor and the patient. And I've seen colleagues leave the profession because they can no longer afford to stay open. And I've had patients who deny themselves care because they can't afford the deductible. So now the meme is, if the new Supreme Court justice comes in, then Affordable Care Act will be thrown out. What's your take on the Affordable Care Act and what we should be doing as a healthcare system?
Well, number one, which I think a lot of people don't remember, is that the individual mandate, that was the mandate that you got taxed if you didn't buy insurance, was already removed out of the Affordable Care Act. And the basic core of it is still there, that insurance companies are running the show. And this was the number one thing that was wrong with it, because over the years, we've seen medicine get captured by the insurance industry and more government involvement and take away that patient-doctor relationship just because of that, having this third party always between you and the doctor, and bringing in all these concepts of population health where we're always going to do whatever is best for the collective, but not for the individual patient. And that's kind of the foundation of the Affordable Care Act, and which is always a joke to say that, because it absolutely was not affordable. Mm-hmm. That all the premiums went up, the deductibles went up, and worse, the choices for patients went down. You look at all these lists of the exchanges and the doctors on the exchanges, and you end up with a handful of insurance companies. Most people, unless they're of a certain age, could not remember that way back when, in the 70s, there were 845 companies that offered health insurance. Now we have just a handful. And let's all think about that. What if the only grocery store was Vons, and you didn't have the other ones, and you didn't have corner stores that catered to your neighborhood or the certain things that you liked? Vons could charge you whatever they wanted, and they might not have all the items you want, because they know that that's the only place you can go. You can't go to the corner store and get that box of Cheerios or whatever. And if they decide they don't want to sell you Cheerios, then they don't have to stock them. And that's how these insurance companies got. And then after people, I think, were kind of lulled into submission when they said, oh, there's 10 essential things that all these plans have to offer you. And oh boy, I'll always get those and I won't have to pay a copay. Well, they weren't such great things in the first place. And they really kind of kept doctors from doing everything they wanted to do on a patient. There were all these little ins and outs and things that patients wouldn't know beforehand. It's like you get a colonoscopy, but then if you get something done because of the colonoscopy, that's no longer free. And while the colonoscope is up there, the doctor's going to do what he has to do, but that part of it isn't free. Well, most people think the whole thing was free, and then they're very surprised when suddenly they get a bill. So there was no transparency about the costs at all, and it was really a bait and switch. And I really, really found that that's what patients didn't like. They thought they were getting so much more. They thought they'd get cheaper drugs, and guess what? Didn't happen. The price of everything went up.
It certainly did. And their out-of-pocket went up for those who had deductibles. And I just want to give a little meat to what you described about the colonoscopy. So if a polyp was found and had to be sent to pathology, or you needed anesthesia to get the colonoscopy done, those two things were not covered. And they're pretty expensive when you think about it. So I think you're absolutely right about the opacity of the whole healthcare system. It's a game. It's a scam. It's run by, unfortunately, middlemen who stand to gain by delaying care, taking a premium, not paying after it's been, whatever service was given in good faith, not paying it out, and then there's no consequence for it. I really personally would like to see, I think the insurance companies have a place in the healthcare system, but they need to be held accountable. And so as a lawyer, a contract is written, is it not? And a patient signs it with the insurance company. And we as doctors sign an insurance or sign a contract, but they don't seem to have to keep their word. And it seems to be fraud, in my opinion. So if a patient comes to me and needs to have a procedure done, I ask the insurance company as a pre-certification to have the procedure done. I walk through all the hoops and they say yes and give me a pre-certification number. The procedure's done and then they deny it arbitrarily. Is that a contract issue? I'm curious to know because I'm done with them.
Well, it's what's interesting about it is most of these folks are able to write these contracts in such a way that they still have the upper hand because there's always words in there like reasonable or as we shall decide or something that always gives them wiggle room. And I always change when somebody says the wording, oh, I got a surprise medical bill from the doctor. No, you didn't. You got the surprise from the insurance company who decided they weren't going to pay the medical bill. It's the idea the doctor still gave you the service. You bought that insurance plan thinking that the doctor's services were going to be covered. And surprise, the insurance decided not to cover it. And they'll say, well, that doctor was out of network. Well, guess what? Whatever it was that you were getting, whatever procedure it was or service you were getting, there was no in-network doctor to deliver it. So you had to go out of network. So the insurance company then treats that doctor like they're some sort of criminal for sending a bill. They did the services. Just mm-hmm. because they aren't in network, are they supposed to do it for free? They define the rules, and that's the problem. We have to start getting our own rules and taking charge.
I think you're right, because it's the patient, 9 times out of 10, that's on the outside looking in. And from a physician standpoint, this Affordable Care Act, and I want to know your opinion on this. It seems to have locked out the independent doctor, the doctor who's not charging thousands of dollars, who actually does know the cost of something and tells the patient. But this is based on big medicine, corporate-driven healthcare. The insurance companies have favored hospitals, who have favored pharmaceutical companies, or I should say drugs, who have favored pharmacies. It's all designed to keep the money in their pot without anybody having real recourse to shop around to find the cheapest iteration of whatever it is. And the system is broken. Single payer to me is just maximizing that system.
Interestingly, one of the things with the new administration from 3 years ago that changed a lot was changing some of these pharmacy rules. It used to be that a pharmacist, if you came in with your insurance card, could not tell you that, hey, Johnny, you know what? If you just paid me out of pocket, this drug would only cost $7. Now I have to charge you $84. And so that makes your copay $20. And so you're paying more than if you just never showed me your insurance card. There was a gag rule. They could not tell that scenario to poor Johnny that came up to get that drug. And so this administration had stopped that gag rule. So they were starting to chip away at some of these things that did not favor the patient. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have to continue doing, is making sure that the patient gets more control. One of the things that's been held up that for years people have tried to expand health savings accounts. That's your tax-free dollars that you can put away and spend on healthcare. And some people argued, well, only rich people can do that, or only some corporations do that. Well, they're trying to change the law so all of us can do that. And amazingly, these are regular actuaries who worked on this, who figured out if you started putting money in your health savings account and you never had anything big happen to you and you'd use insurance for the big things like a big operation or something, but not for your day-to-day medical care, you could have $300,000 by the time you retire. And some of the rules that people would like to see changed for health savings account is making it so you can keep it, so you can give it to your children or your heirs. There's a whole lot of ways that to make it so the patients can decide what to do with their money. And that's what it comes down to, that you get kind of tired of having the government tell you what you can do with your money, or taking the tax dollars and spending it on something that is totally ridiculous to you. Whereas if you had the money, you could spend it on what you wanted. And if other people think it's ridiculous, well, that's their problem. It's your life. Do what you want with it.
I think that's a really great example. I remember when the president was running, that was one of the things in his platform was, you should be able to have your health savings account, use it as wealth, pass it to your loved ones as a way to give to your family. I think from what we're seeing, if people had more control over their bottom line, I don't think we would have so much waste. I think things would be a lot cheaper. I think that people would become healthcare consumers and ask questions. It's this mindset now that if I have an insurance card, then I'm not paying for it, and I'm getting insurance companies paying for it. And so there's no dog in the hunt, no skin in the game. And that really should stop. I know we have to take a break, and I actually want to get your take on the exact platform, what the president recently put out as his healthcare plan. Because the Affordable Care Act, is, as we just discussed, is not the answer. But do you think, and what has he said, and do you think it's going to work? So let's take our second break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living in the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Marilyn Singleton. And before the break, we were talking about the Affordable Care Act, the good and the bad associated with it. And I know about a week and a half ago, the president had a ceremony where he put out his new healthcare plan. What is it? I know part of it is the health savings account, I'm pretty sure, but what else is in there?
Well, some of the things he's doing Well, let's talk about just ways to control your own healthcare money. So we do have the health savings account, health reimbursement arrangements that would come through your employer. And one of the keys in this is giving financial assistance directly to the people rather than to the insurance companies, because the Affordable Care Act gave the money to the insurance companies. This way, people would get it. And they're talking about having just like the HSA cards, that if you have one, you take it to the doctor and they run it just like a credit card or a debit card where it just runs the amount down. You could do the same thing for people who qualify as you know, needy, or however they make these tiers, that you get a card directly from the government and you can spend the money. And again, like Dr. George said, if you're controlling it, you're not going to spend your healthcare dollars on Tootsie Rolls. You're going to spend it where you really need it. You're going to shop around if you're in a position to do so. If, you know, for folks who live in larger cities, if you're out in the middle of the country, you may only have one place to go, admittedly. But one of the things that will happen with this, you're going to get insurance companies to start playing the game. They can't push you around anymore if they know that you have more places to go. So one of the things that the new plan is trying to do is having smaller insurance companies offer health insurance plans that are more individualized instead of that one size fits all. Because what had happened with the Affordable Care Act is all insurance companies had to give maternity care and all this. Well, what if you're a single gay guy? So you're not going to have a baby. And why should you be paying for maternity care? What if you're a woman of 50 who's not going to have a baby? Why would you pay for maternity care? So you could get an insurance policy where the premiums are going to be much lower, because you're only going to use it for things that happen to people over 50. So having these tailored plans, and that's how they used to be, where you could have very high deductibles. That's another thing, to make the choice to have a high deductible plan, but with a lower premium. What happened with the Affordable Care Act? They had high deductible plans, but they kept the premiums high. The whole point of high deductible was that you basically would never use it unless something happened to you. And I feel very blessed that the only thing that's ever, quote unquote, happened to me was having a baby. And that's the only health expense I've had to have. And for most people, they really don't have something huge happen to them. And I know this sounds kind of ghoulish, but when you think about it, the things that happen to people, like an auto accident or something like that, that's going to be paid for by your auto insurance. So it's not, think about what you use your health insurance for, why you see the doctor. And this will be something that becomes more of the kitchen table discussion, where you actually are able to map out, what do I need? I need something if I have appendicitis and need my appendix out, or have a baby or whatever, and be able to choose a particular insurance policy for that. And this is how it used to be. And most people around now don't remember that, as more and more the larger companies have taken over. But we all know what it's like losing your smaller hardware stores or smaller grocery stores or whatever to the big box. And it's the same thing that happened with health insurance. But this is something that needs to be personalized. And we just have to remember that you look for something that you can determine more what happens, and you can get your premiums lowered. And it's been shown, because some states have taken waivers from the rules of the ACA, and they've been able to lower the premiums as much as 30%. So basically, this would give a nationwide waiver from the rules of the ACA.
That sounds like it's user-friendly. And again, we preach on the show, it's about choice and being able to be free to make your own decisions. Is there also a part of it that also incorporates health sharing ministries, as you can use your health savings account to pay for those shared amounts?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one of the things that's being pushed now and is kind of almost there, maybe 75% of the way there, is to be able to use the health savings account to pay the fees if you go to a direct primary care subscription practice. So opening things up where you aren't penalized for trying to do something innovative. And in fact, it's innovative things that ultimately end up saving money. And I think people know that. In your heart, you know it, and have other examples in your day-to-day life. And that's just what we need to do with healthcare. Just look at it like it's not this boogeyman that's so different from everything else. Yes, it's different in that something can befall you through no fault of your own, but that's how insurance began. Insurance began with ships crossing the ocean, and the people who ran the companies who ran the ships just kind of said, well, if our ship sinks, I guess we lost some money. And then that's how insurance came in, when they said, well, pay us some money and we'll pay for your loss. But the idea was insurance paying for something big, not for day-to-day stuff, not for your oil change, but for something big.
When did that change happen? Because to me, when I was in medical school, medical school, people paid for everything out of pocket, and they used their insurance for surgeries and to go for labs, but it wasn't the same thing. Do you think it started when the capitation thing started in, was it 95, 6 or whatever, where they were paying the first dollar at that point?
Well, when the HMO Act, that was actually took place when Nixon was president, and back in the 70s, but it didn't really balloon until the 90s, as you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. And it kind of got used to people saying, oh, well, it's all going to be taken care of. And then over time, what people realized is they weren't necessarily getting what they paid for. Yes, I might not have to walk in and pay any more than a $5 copay or whatever, but then I also couldn't get the drug I wanted. I couldn't get the surgery I wanted. Suddenly they decided what medically necessary was. That's the famous term that's used. And so again, it was kind of a bait and switch, but it got people used to not paying. And it comes down to, you'd like to get what you want. And we Americans are a hard to please bunch. And we do like getting what we want. We don't like being pushed around.
No, I sure don't. So I want to briefly touch base about this, again, a meme that if you leave Affordable Care Act, then no pre-existing conditions will be covered. I think it's a fear tactic. I want to know what you think about that.
Well, it would scare people, because a lot of people have something wrong with them at this point in life. And the question is how you best do it without the person with the pre-existing condition paying quintuple what a person who's perfectly healthy does. But one of the methods to do this, and it's an interesting psychological and practical method, is if you buy insurance from the get-go, even from birth, and always keep it, and with reasonable premiums, of course, your conditions will always be covered. And people say, well, what happens if a baby is born with a problem? Babies, in fact, a lot of people don't even know this, in many, many states are covered by something special if you happen to have a congenital problem. So these babies aren't out there with no coverage whatsoever. So that's kind of something sometimes is used politically, show you a sad little baby, but guess what? That baby is getting treated anyway. But this would encourage people to keep their insurance. Now, because what would happen if somebody didn't buy insurance and then they had something wrong with them and suddenly they wanted to buy insurance for the same rate as somebody else? Mm-hmm. That's not really fair. And I always hate to use the word fair, but you have to look at it as a way to put money in that insurance pot, that you have to have money put in, just like when you buy your auto insurance, you pay it year after year and never get in an accident. You get in an accident and sometimes it costs more than you've even put in. If you've only had it a couple of years, then get in an accident. And health insurance can be kind of the same way. Now, when you change something midstream, there has to be some mechanism that would take care of folks. And this is, of course, what the bean counters are busily working on. How do you take care of these folks without charging them way more money than everybody else? And so, honestly, not being a bean counter myself, but knowing insurance law, that there's formulas to work this out. And with the federal government, certainly that's where these vouchers come in. But again, mm-hmm. the voucher directly to the patient, not to the insurer.
Well, let's think about that and take our last break. You're Living in the Solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Marilyn Singleton. Again, her website is marilynsingletonmdjd.com. And there's a really good article that's on the top of the page, The Canary in the Constitutional Mind is Gasping. And, you know, the Affordable Care Act had a lot of, before the current administration got rid of the mandate, it really was very onerous if you think about it. Someone's telling you have to buy something that you don't necessarily need or want. You're going to be taxed if you don't. And if I recall correctly, a lot of people just forwent, whatever the word is, they didn't buy the insurance because it was cheaper for them not to have it and then show up in an ER. That says a lot about the Affordable Care Act, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And one of the whole points that they said prior to the passage or immediately post-passage was, well, if everybody has insurance, then people won't go to the ERs. And then it turned out just as many people went to the ER.
I do remember that.
Yes.
I also remember when it passed, our patient days dropped like a rock because people thought that they were going to get something for free and they walked in and they had a copay or their deductible was outrageous and they were like just turned on their heel and walked right back out. So, I mean, in my experience, and I've never seen a law that says does what it says it does. It's usually the opposite. So Affordable Care Act, it was really not affordable. It wasn't about choice. But I think it was about changing how our healthcare system literally works from the bottom up. I remember reading parts of it about not about having extra seats to train doctors, but seats for nurses and nurse assistants. And it seems like it spent a lot of time changing the healthcare workforce. Did you think that?
Absolutely. And these are the things, and no one is expected to sit there and read all 1,100 pages of it, included paying off student loans, which most people don't realize that was part of the Affordable Care Act, moving all student loans to the government. But that's in a little aside there. When you looked at where they put the money, you're absolutely right. They put money to nurse education, and something that in my view, thankfully didn't pass that came after that was they then decided, oh, I guess we better give some money to residencies. Well, what residency did they give money to? Not anesthesia, not ear, nose, and throat, but hospice care. Cool. And isn't that interesting?
Eh? Yeah, very.
That was the one residency they wanted to fund. And that's a scary thought to me. I want hospice and palliative care as much as the next person, but I don't want to be shoved into it before my time. I remember, and this is personal story, my mother was 87 and had always been in good health, no surgery, no nothing, just a little high blood pressure. And she got pneumonia. And so this poor woman couldn't have been in the hospital more than a half hour before the hospice people were in the room. I sent them away. I said, I haven't even seen a nurse, and you people are in here having her on hospice? Well, she lived for almost 3 years after she was supposed to be ready for the grave. So it, so that's what's kind of scary, because I'm a big believer in palliative care and hospice for those who need it, but not to push people into it just because they happen to be old.
I think there are younger people ending up in hospice during this time too. I remember a show that I think we did together, and you were telling me stories about how people were being discharged from hospice because they were living too long. I mean, this is a it's a money-making venture. Follow the money. The fact that they would pay doctors to talk about end-of-life care, but not pay to get a hip done or a cataract fixed, should say it all, shouldn't it?
That's right. And it's sort of this, as you point out, these things are done bit by bit. It sort of trains you to accept control. It trains you to say, oh, well, I guess old people should die. And it's subtle, sometimes not so subtle. I just don't think that's American. That might sound hokey, but it just seems un-American. We like our freedom. We like our choices. And so don't tell me what to do.
Exactly. And, you know, if we like to get a good deal too, to tell you the truth. So if we know that not entering this system, this rigid system, this corporatized system, that is cheaper, that you can have choices to go natural, holistic if you like, that you don't need to take a medication, that you can, if you do need one, you can, or need surgery, you can leave the country and go and do it in another country. I mean, there's so many options for healthcare. And ultimately, what you said at the beginning of our talk is really key. The only way to put pressure on this system is to have a parallel alternate system. They know right now that they're the only game in town. They will screw you up left and right and not think about it at all, which they've been doing. I mean, fighting for a patient to get a procedure done that is recommended by your specialty body and some no face, no name actuary and insurance company decides, well, that's not medically necessary, is completely ridiculous. Where is the AMA talking about an entity that's not a physician going against the specialty recommendations of whatever specialty you're in? That doesn't make sense to me that that's allowed to happen.
Absolutely not. And, you know, sadly, some of the people who were authorizing surgeries or procedures aren't even doctors.
True.
And they have an algorithm that they're following. And when you call them to try to explain that, no, I have to do it this way, and I can't wait a week between for the next authorization because you have to do the procedure every day, whatever it might be. I feel if I could see them on the other end of the telephone, I feel like their mouth would be hanging open and their eyes wide open, like I didn't understand a word you said, nor will I ever. Denied. And we had a good lawsuit out here in California for some poor young man who had leukemia, and they fooled around with him so much that he ultimately died, and they finally approved the treatment. But by the time they approved it, he was dead. And it turned out that when the doctor who was in charge of these approvals admitted that he never even saw the request, that some underling saw it and it was denied and it never went higher up the food chain. So this is a case that actually went to court and was exposed. Imagine how much of that is happening every day.
I can't. I think it's very common. But what was the outcome? Is the doctor held liable? Is the insurance company held liable? If they're going to practice medicine, then they should be held liable. And I really believe that would stop this whole thing if they're on the hook for the person with the late diagnosis. It's not the doctor. We're up there trying to help our patients, and these guys are thwarting us at every step, every turn. If it's over a certain amount of money, they're going to fight you and not pay you or make you wait weeks to get approvals, but they don't have any skin in the game. Why is that?
Hey, this has happened all along. I think one of the things that helped along this line actually was Enron. I don't know if you remember, that was the big scandal, however many years ago it was. Mm-hmm. And these corporate types were actually held liable. And so these things are generally in state court, so it's going to vary between states. But in California, amazingly, we got pretty tough on them and made them liable, that this is what the patients are counting on, and they do not expect for their health care to be delayed because of the insurance company. And I'll tell you, this would happen much more, but it's because of doctors like you who will see somebody even without a pre-authorization if the person really needs it and you know that they need to be seen right away. You'll mm-hmm. see them anyway. And this is what happens. When I didn't get some nerve blocks approved, they had some funny little thing. They say, well, we'll approve it next month. And I say, if I don't do it this month, then the person's going to get permanent pain syndrome. And they don't approve it. You do it anyway, because yeah. we're doctors. And doctors are doing this all the time. But you certainly can't afford to do it to every single patient. And but we ourselves keep the insurance companies out of trouble because we go ahead and treat the patient anyway.
Well, as Hippocratic Oath actually means something to us. Now, in the minute that we have left, how can people reach you?
Well, just go to the website, MarilynSingletonMDJD.com, and there's a contact me button there, and I'll directly get the email, and love to hear from you.
Oh, I'm just so happy that you've come on the show. I've had another tutorial on Affordable Care Act since I kind of stopped thinking about it for a while. But now that it's come back up, I think people need to understand that elections have consequences and need to think about your future and your family's future and not vote because of emotion. That doesn't keep you out of the hospital or keep you healthy, does it?
Absolutely not. And just remember, if you think the insurance companies are in the driver's seat, imagine when the government is your only choice of insurer.
That just gave me a chill when you said that. On that note, thank you so much. It's just a pleasure to have you back on. I can't wait to have you back on again.
Me too. I always enjoy it.
Me too. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.